Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakti Rindu Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Ma Om Vishnu Vidaya, Krishna Vrishnaya, Vukamishu Vati, Bhakti Vidaya, Swami Niti Namini. Namaste, Sarasvati Vidaya, Gaur Hari Pachani, Nivasesa, Sundivari Paska, Jyadi Sitarani. Vandeham Guru Sri Yuta Parakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavanascha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahana Radhita Sri Vishakam Vitam Stam. Manchakapati Vistaki Dasanviya Vitapti Jumam Pavaneva Sri Guru. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's April 27th, 2015, in Hillsboro, North Carolina. And today is what, the appearance day, you said? Appearance day of
Sita, the wife of
Advaita Acharya. Sita, the wife of Advaita Acharya, and Janava Mata.
And
Madhu Pandit's disappearance day. So before I read the Bhagavatam, we'll just speak very briefly. So I find it very interesting that Advaita Acharya is often called Sitapati, the husband of Sita. And we find this in general, the name of the Lord is Lakshmipati, or Radhanath, Radhapati. And, you know, it used to be in Western countries that women were only known by their husband's name. You know, I mean, when I was a little girl, not only if Lucy married John Smith, she was not just called Lucy Smith, she was called Mrs. John Smith. She actually fully took on the husband's name. That she really didn't have much of a separate identity. But here we see that in the Shastra, that often the man is known by the wife's name. You know, Sitapati, Sita's husband. So I think this is very interesting. A lot of our ideas about the Vedic, you know, position of men and women are probably more influenced by recent Western history than by the Shastras. So sometimes, you know, when we think about what does it mean to be, that women should be married, of course, if women are married, then naturally men are also married, but that women should be married and they should be submissive wives and so forth, we have some picture out of, like, you know, 1950, 1960, which is as much a result of the Industrial Revolution as anything else. And we don't think about what was, we don't look first to the Shastras. And this is a very major problem, as discussed, like yesterday, Birkrishna Swami was talking about the problem of induction. So one of the problems of induction is that we look at facts through a cultural bias. Even the empirical institutions list six problems with induction. You mentioned one of them yesterday, but another one is that we have a cultural bias. So when we look at facts through the lens of our particular culture. We don't really look at them impartially. And today's verse goes on with the subject of impartiality. So we really don't have impartiality as long as we're under the modes of material nature. And therefore, even though in the Shastra, Advaita Acharya is called Sitapati, it doesn't register in our brain that such ways of speaking are also indicative of culture. Language and culture is very connected. So of course, Sita is very connected with Satyamata. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, Sita Devi came and she gave very wonderful gifts to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we also see in that pastime the sweetness of village life, not only the sweetness of bhakti and the sweetness of giving gifts in bhakti, but how, you know, we like to say it takes a village to raise a child. I tried to put the mic up and it keeps falling down. Even Dayavir Prabhu tried to fix it and it keeps flying out. So hopefully Yeah, well, we tried to tighten it, and it just...
Okay.
Yeah, all right. Hopefully it'll stay like that. Very good. This is just like the living entity in the material world. They keep going up, and then they fall down again, right? They go to the higher planets, and they come back to Earth. So this microphone is very symbolic of that. Anyway, there was such a wonderful relationship in the village life that everyone was helping everybody else. People were not isolated. I think another problem that we have in trying to apply Varnashram, the very word itself seems to be a taboo term sometimes in our Hare Krishna movement. But part of Varnashram is having communities where people help each other. The concept of a nuclear family where everyone lives in their own little house and they only move about in their cars. You know, I remember Keshav told me he picked up a woman from India to work in their prasadam business. So he was picking her up from the airport and driving her to her place to stay. And she said, "Where's all the people?" You know, you go in the West and it's just houses and shops and the streets are empty except for cars. People are not interacting with each other except through their machines. So we have a very nice example in the relationship between Sita Devi and Satyamurtha. Maybe Maharaj will talk more about Sita Devi tomorrow. So also today is the appearance day of Janavamata. And of course, Janavamata was not only a guru, but she was one of our acharyas. She was one of our acharyas. So there's many, many, many gurus. Of course, practically uncountable gurus in the Sampradaya. Only the main ones are listed in our list in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. And that's actually a list of the main Shiksha gurus. It's not even a Diksha line. So Janavamata was both a Diksha and a Shiksha guru. But in addition to that, she was the acharya among the Gaudiyas. And at the big festival at Kecharikam, which was really the beginning of, you could say, the unification of the Gaudiya society, started with that festival at Kecharikam. She was the main leader and organizer of that festival. There were installation of deities and wonderful kirtans by Narottama Das Thakur. She organized and personally served the prasadam to the devotees, showing that an acharya is also a servant. Of course, she was also a traveling preacher. She traveled with a group of devotees. And of course, today, when you're a traveling preacher, that means you go on airplanes, right, and cars and trains and things like that. But in those days, being a traveling preacher meant you travel by foot. You know, she was walking around India with her entourage, spreading Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's glories. So, very wonderful, amazing personality. And of course, at Radhakund, she has her bathing ghat. You can go to Janavamata's bathing ghat. And it is said that there she sees across the crystal bridge in the Kund that's visible in the upper Kat Lila to the place of Ananga Manjari, who she is. So very wonderful. Wonderful acharya in our line. So we want to look today at this impartiality. Right? I think especially people like Sita Devi and Janavamata, if one is truly impartial, then one sees their genuine role in our Gaudiya history. And somehow when we get covered by our biases, even though we read about such people, somehow we reinterpret them in a way that's not just the obvious understanding of their lives. Okay, so this, we're going on here with answering the question of Maharaj Parikit of is the Lord or is he not partial? So this is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 1, The Supreme Lord is equal to everyone, Text 6. Nirgunopi yajo vyakto.
That's yesterday's.
Oh, that was yesterday. Seven. We are very confused today. Satvam rajas tama iti. Prakriter nat manoguna. Natesham yuga padrajam. Rasa ula saevava. Please chant.
Satvam rajas tamahiti.
Satvam rajas tamahiti.
Prakriter nat manoguna.
Prakriter nat manoguna.
Natesham yuga padrajam.
Natesham yuga padrajam.
Rasa ula saevava.
Rasa ula saevava.
Satvam rajas tamahiti.
Satvam rajas tamah iti.
Prakriter nat manoguna.
Natesham yuga padrajam.
Satam Rajas Tamayiti.
Satam Rajas Tamayiti.
Prakrite Nadmano Guna.
Prakrite Nadmano Guna.
Nate Sham Yugapad Raja.
Nate Sham Yugapad Raja.
Rasa Ulasa Eva Bha.
Rasa Ulasa Eva Bha.
Satam Rajas Tamayiti.
Satam Rajas Tamayiti.
Satvam, the mode of goodness, Rajaha, the mode of passion, Tamaha, the mode of ignorance, Iti, thus, Prakritihe, of material nature, Na, not, Atmanaha, of the spirit soul, Gunaha, qualities, Na, not, Tesham, of them, Yugapat, simultaneously, Rajan, O King, Rasaha, diminution, Ulasaha, prominence, Eva, certainly, Va, or, translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. My dear King Parikshit, the material qualities, Sattvagun, Rajagun, and Tamagun, all belong to the material world and do not even touch the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These three gunas cannot act by increasing or decreasing simultaneously. Purport. The original position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is one of equality. There is no question of his being influenced by Sattvagun, Rajagun, or Tamagun, for these material qualities cannot touch the Supreme Lord. The Lord is therefore called the Supreme Ishwara, Ishwara Padama Krishnaha. He is the Supreme Controller. He controls the material qualities, Daivyesha Gunamayi Mama Maya. Mayadakshena Prakriti Suyate, material nature Prakriti works under his order. How then can he be under the qualities of Prakriti? Krishna is never influenced by the material qualities. Therefore, there is no question of partiality in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Satvam Rajas Tama Iti, Prakriti Arnatamo Guna, Natesham Yugapad Rajam, Rasa Ulas Eva. My dear King Parikshit, the material qualities, Sattvagun, Rajagun, and Tamagun, all belong to the material world and do not even touch the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These three gunas cannot act by increasing or decreasing simultaneously. So here again we're talking about equality and fairness. And this is an urge within the human being. We mentioned the other day that sociologists have analyzed that there are five universal moral principles: purity, authority, fairness, community, and harmony. And of those five, here we're dealing with fairness. What is fair? That everybody should be treated equally. This is one of the main principles in the United States Constitution, that everybody is equal under the law, that nobody gets favoritism under the law. The law is applied to everybody blindly, right? This is the picture of justice, blind justice. I don't see who you are. I don't see how rich you are. I don't see how beautiful you are. I don't see what race you're from, how intelligent you are, whatever. That justice is applied fairly. And this is something we all hanker for. And this question that Maharaj Parikshit asks, is the Lord fair, is the main point of the atheist. It's actually the only point of the atheist. The atheists have one logical point against the existence of God, and that is that the world appears to be unfair. I mean, otherwise, it's obvious, just like there's obvious somebody made this curtain, which is a very simple thing. So if somebody made the curtain, somebody had to have made the tree, which is far more complex. Somebody would have had to make the sun. You know, if somebody made cars and airplanes, somebody would have to make the planets. This is just simple, simple logic. But yet so many people lose faith in the concept of God, that God exists, because they see, apparently, unfairness. It appears to be unfair. I mean, even in our birth, each of us has a very different birth than others. Some of us are born unhealthy. Some of us are born deformed. Some of us are born into poverty. Some of us are born ugly or born without much intelligence or severely handicapped. And others are born with great riches and beauty and wealth. And, right? I mean, so there's such a disparity. And then there's such a disparity in the opportunities of our lives. So this is a very big question. And I think it's even a very big question even for devotees who accept the principle of karma and fairness. That why does it seem to be that some devotees make more advancement than others? You know, why you see that many devotees are following the same process and some advance very quickly and some go on decades and decades and decades and hardly take a step in devotional service internally, isn't it? Right? And we see the different devotees seem to have different advantages even in devotional service. Now, some devotees have just lots and lots of facility for hearing and chanting and serving the deity, and other people have very little facility. We talked about obstacles the other day. Some people are in a family where their family prohibits them from engaging in Krishna consciousness. You know, they're not even allowed to come to a temple. They have to sneak and lie and cheat to come to a temple. Or some of them live so far from a temple and they don't have the money to travel. Right? Or some people may be very ill and they can't even get out of bed. They're an invalid and they hardly have any opportunity to do any external service. So it appears like that. Even from our perspective, it may seem unfair. You know, why does one person get more opportunity for bhakti than others? And why do people engaged in the same process, apparently with the same sincerity, why do some of them make very rapid advancement and others don't? So this is it's a very deep doubt that we have. And we find this doubt comes out a lot when devotees talk about mercy. The other night at the home program, one of the devotees asked, it's a repeating question, what's the relationship between endeavor and mercy? You know, we have this idea that Krishna's mercy is somehow whimsical. You know, you just have to somehow be at the right place at the right time or whatever, you know, to get that mercy. And if you don't get that mercy, well, you're sort of out of luck. So these are our very deep doubts. And therefore, Maharaj Pariksit is asking a question that's relevant to everyone. I think it's relevant to materialists, and it's also relevant to spiritualists. And he's giving many different answers. As he said, he's going to give answers based on the authorities. He's not giving answers from his own speculation. And this is one of his answers, that there is no question that the Lord is partial. He's equal to everyone. Why? Because he's above the modes of material nature. And how do we know he's above the modes of material nature? Because it says in the Shastra, he's the controller of the modes. As Prabhupada quotes here too, Daivyesha Gunamayi Mamamai, it's my energy, right? Or Maya Dakshana Prakriti Suyate Sacharachara. I'm controlling the material energy. When someone's controlling something, they're not also controlled by it. Just rationally. Right? Like the Prabhupada would say, there's a Bengali expression, the sweet maker, he's not attracted to his sweets. It doesn't hold any attraction for him. So the magician is not fooled by his own illusions. And we may see some amazing illusions by a magician. Where, oh, wow, how did you do that? You know, is it just some trick or do you really have mystic power? But the magician himself, he's not enamored by his own tricks. He knows what he's doing. Isn't it a fact? Right? When the actors who are in a movie, when they watch the movie, they're not bewildered by it. Because they know what was really going on. I remember when I was about 10 and I went to visit Hollywood. And I went to on the set of a television show that I used to watch all the time. I got to meet the actors and actresses. And once I saw the set, then I could never get the same enjoyment from the show. It was quite interesting. You know, in the set, when you watch it on television, it looked like they went upstairs and there was another room, but the actual set was quite different than that. They were just creating an illusion. So those who create the illusion are not themselves bewildered by the illusion. I mean, it's just not possible. Not only those who create the illusion are not bewildered by the illusion, even those who see the illusion are not bewildered by the illusion. And this is one of the arguments given frequently in the scriptures and by Srila Prabhupada, that if the devotees of the Lord are above the modes of nature, how can the Lord be under the modes of nature? What is it? Mamcha yogi avicharina bhakti yogi na sevate sagunan samatichaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpati. When Arjuna asks, how do you become free from the modes of nature? Krishna says, if you're engaged in devotional service to me, you're above the modes of nature. Or janma karma tame divyam evam yo veti tatvata twakta deham punar janma naiti mam eti sorjuna. If you just understand about Krishna, you become free from this cycle of birth and death. You become free from this illusion. So if those who know Krishna, if those who surrender to Krishna are free from illusion, if they come to the platform of being fair, then how can Krishna be partial? Right, we have just the pandit, vijavanaya sampane ramane gavihastane suni chada asupake ja pandita samadarshina. That's just the pandit becomes samadarshina. And when Krishna is explaining in the Bhagavad Gita what are the symptoms of those who are above the modes of material nature, or the symptoms of those who are his devotees, the main theme is equanimity. If you study all those verses about what are the main symptoms of an enlightened being, a self-realized being, that what gets repeated over and over and over again is equanimity. Equal to friends and enemy. Seeing friends, enemy in the neutral with an equal mind. Seeing pebbles, gold, and stone as the same. Not being affected by happiness and distress, by heat and cold, by what's auspicious, by what's inauspicious. Not being attached to any residence. I mean, all these things, or Krishna says in the 14th chapter, one who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear. So this is the qualities. It's even realized to some extent in Satvaguna, what to speak of transcendence. So there's no possibility that Krishna is partial. His apparent partiality is due to our own covering of the modes of material nature. And as we said in the beginning in reference to Sita Devi and Janakamata, that it's well known above empiric researchers and empiric philosophers that our cultural and individual biases color our ability to see reality. This is just a well-known fact. I mean, it's quite interesting, you know, when you're in the bachelor's program, they say empirical science is the key to knowledge. And when you're in the master's program, they say empirical science is the key to knowledge. And you get in the PhD program and they say, by the way, empirical science is a bunch of hogwash. I mean, they just write, or they just tell you. You know, and in their own journals, which are practically indecipherable to ordinary people with the kind of language, vocabulary, and sentence construction that they use. It takes you an hour to read and decipher one page in these journals. They talk about how their empirical science is just garbage. And these are two of the reasons. One, we have an individual bias, and the other is that we have a collective, a cultural bias. And therefore, you don't see things clearly. Now, where does this individual and cultural bias come from? It comes from the modes of material nature. So why do we have a covering of the modes of material nature? We have a covering of the modes of material nature because we desire not to see the truth. It's really that simple. It's like, why does somebody pay to see a movie? Because they desire to forget their life, right? They want to forget their life. That's why people take intoxicants. That's why they watch movies. That's why they, you know, read ordinary books. That's why they surf the internet. They want to forget about their lives. That's why they play computer games. They want to pretend they're someone else, someplace else. They want to enter into a state of forgetfulness. And in a similar way, right, you want to forget who you are, and then you get covered by the computer game, you get covered by the movie, whatever it is. It covers your intelligence, and you think you're somewhere else doing something else. So we want to forget that we're eternal servants of God. Jivara Swabhaya Krishna Nityadas. We want to forget that. We actually hate ourselves. It says that the demons are envious of themselves. You know, for a long time, what does that mean? It means that we hate the fact that we're a servant. We hate our nature. We want to destroy our own. When you're envious of something, you want to destroy it. We want to destroy our own nature. But that is our nature. We're eternally servants of Krishna. We're eternally part and parcel of Krishna. You can't destroy your nature. So the only way that you can so-called destroy it is to not see it, to be covered, to be put in some sort of an illusion. And this illusion has, 8,400,000 varieties, and actually even more varieties, because those are just the main species. I mean, all of us in this room, I hope we are in the same species. I think so. Sometimes I wonder if I'm from a lower planet. But anyway, we're all the same species. But yet we all have a slightly different covering of the modes, isn't it? Right? The particular combination of the modes that's covering me is just like we each have in our body different fingerprints, different DNA. So in the same way, the particular flavor of modal covering for each of us is different. Yet we can say in rather a simplistic way that there's sattva, rajas, and tamas. So depending on how much illusion we want to be in, we have these coverings. You know, if you want to be in almost total forgetfulness that there's a God and that you're a soul, then you get to be in tamas. It's like having a big blanket over your head. You know, it's like being in a very, 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 very thick fog, or having light, what do they call that? The curtains that take out the light in a room. Anyway, blackout curtains, thank you. So it's like having blackout curtains in your room. It can be a brilliant sunny day and you're not aware of it. Why do people have blackout curtains? They want to sleep in the middle of the day. Otherwise they don't buy blackout curtains. Right? So this tamagun is like that. And in tamagun, you really see almost like an animal. In tamagun, you very much see things in terms of friends and enemies. And friends and enemies are in terms of gross sense gratification. You're very much thinking just in terms of the bodily senses. What will please the senses of the body? You know, I just want good food and good sex and a nice shelter. And, you know, it's very, very, very bodily. And the world is full of friends and enemies. And everything is partial. If somebody facilitates my sense gratification, they're a friend. And if they block my sense gratification, they're an enemy. And all that life is about securing my position with my friends and neutralizing my enemies and trying to get more sense gratification than anybody else. You know, going to the sales on Black Friday and pushing everybody out of the way, and if somebody's trampled to death, oh well, at least I got my TV. You know, that's very much the mode of ignorance. And in the mode of ignorance, there's no question of seeing God. We were talking about yesterday. Those in the mode of ignorance, their knowledge is confined to the work they do. It's very meager. All they understand is this is what I do to satisfy my senses. Just exactly like an animal. You know, all an animal thinks about is where do I get food, where do I get a mate, where do I get shelter, where do I get protection, as Prabhupada would put it, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. An animal doesn't ask, who am I, why am I suffering, what am I doing here, what's the purpose of life? Of course, people in the mode of ignorance can also take up religion. Lord Kapila Dev talks about that. But religion in the mode of ignorance is also very much about friends and enemies. We are the Sunni Muslims, you are the Shiite Muslims, we're going to kill you. You know, we are the Muslims, we are the Jews, you are the Catholics, we are the Protestants. It's very much like that. That God is only in my temple, God is my possession. I use God to get sense gratification and to justify my sense gratification. I basically justify my friends and enemies mentality in the name of religion. And people in the mode of ignorance see God as a very angry, envious, jealous God, like themselves. Atmavan Mandatejpat. You know, they'll put up these signs, God hates gays or something like that. I mean, this because that's how they see the world. Because they're full of this ichidvesha. They therefore think God is full of this ichidvesha, that God is full of envy. And then if one has a little bit less desire to forget oneself, then one's covering is a little less. Like translucent glass, you know, you're still covered, but you can see something. And we were giving that quote yesterday, how Prabhupada says in the mode of passion, you get a little bit idea of God through philanthropy, through art, through culture, through poetry. Right? In the mode of passion, you want to be a righteous person. So you still want to satisfy your senses, but you're also just in satisfying the mind. You're not just interested in the senses, you've come to the mind. And you want to satisfy your senses and your mind through righteous means. And generally people in the mode of passion, they want to have some relationship with God for the purpose of satisfying their senses and their mind, undoubtedly. They still want to use God. But even in the mode of passion, you're thinking very much in terms of friends and enemies. Now, you think in terms of friends and enemies a little differently. It's not just about your own personal sense gratification. Because people in the mode of passion, again, think of the righteous king. They're really into justice and equality. They're really into social justice. It's the people in the mode of passion who really build the schools and hospitals. They're the great benefactors and the philanthropists in society. And they want to change the world for the better. This is very much the mood in the mode of passion. So in the mode of passion, they also are thinking in terms of friends and enemies. They're thinking anyone who works for social justice, they're my friend, and anyone who doesn't, they're my enemy. You know, I met one, a god sister recently, who's dedicated herself to the animal rights movement. And it's very interesting. She said a number of interesting things about it. She said how the people who work for these animal rights movement, she said they're not like the devotees. They're not really selfless. They're really there thinking about themselves. And even though they're working for animal rights, she said they don't tend to be necessarily very kind people. Often they themselves are very violent in the way they try to get animal rights. You know, and that they see the people who are torturing the animals as an enemy to be destroyed. This is what Dharma the Bull says. When you name the perpetrator, you become as evil as the perpetrator. So they're often using just as violent and horrible methods against the animal killers as the animal killers are using against the animals. It's quite interesting. So this is the problem in the mode of passion. In the mode of passion, you also are seeing this way of you're very much focused, in fact, in the mode of passion, you're very much focused on inequality. In the mode of ignorance, you're very much focused on inequality for yourself. You know, I'm not getting enough. I'm not getting enough. Why are other people getting more than me? In the mode of passion, you're very much focused on inequality for the society. You know, why is there mistreatment of this race, or why is there mistreatment of women, or why is there mistreatment of animals? This is your main focus. And you want to fix all this through karmakanda and your own strength. Of course, you want to get a lot of credit for it. So even though you're praying to God, you're praying to God because you want to be revered as a godly person. And you're fixing the world so you can be revered as a great person and you can have a good birth and you can go to heaven. So someone in the mode of passion also cannot see the neutrality and the equality of the Lord because their whole consciousness is absorbed in inequality. Now in sattva-gun, you can see to a large extent. We can think of sattva-gun as like glass. You know, you can see, Krishna says in sattva-gun, you can see what is binding, what is liberating, what is to be done, what is not to be done. And you see that there's one spiritual nature in all living entities. And you do see that the world is fair. You see that everything is perfectly arranged. But the mode of goodness is not yet complete. And two reasons the mode of goodness is not yet complete. One of them is that the mode of goodness is still about me. My motivation in the mode of goodness is that it's so wonderful to feel that inner harmony and peace and balance. And I'm just relishing that. You know, the person in the mode of passion, they're relishing, I'm great. And everybody notices it. The person in the mode of ignorance is just relishing how good the pizza tastes. And the person in the mode of goodness, they're relishing that, you know, warm, expansive feeling of equality. That's one reason it's sometimes hard to preach to people in the mode of goodness, because they think they're already very spiritual. So that's one problem with the mode of goodness. It's still about me. It's still not really truth, because I still don't exactly have Krishna at the center. I want to be centered, but it's a question of me being centered. And the other problem with the mode of goodness is indicated in this verse, where we have Rasa, Ulasa, Evava, that the modes are always in competition. And this is why if you try to become, this is a very important point, my dear friends, it's a really very important point. If we try to develop good qualities and be a devotee, not through transcendence, but through sattva-gun, we will not be able to maintain it. We will not be able to maintain it because the modes are always in competition. So you can be free of lust by coming to sattva-gun, and then one day the mode of ignorance is going to hit you in the back of the head and you're going to fall victim again. You know, you might go for years and years and years and years and years without becoming angry at anybody by the power of sattva-gun. And then Rajagun or Tamagun comes along and knocks you over, and then you're furious. So when we try to get good qualities simply by moving up through the modes, it's unstable. It's unstable. The modes are always vying for supremacy. And our body and mind, as Prabhupada explains in the purport to 14.22-25, our bodies and minds are subject to being affected by these different modes. So therefore, even in the mode of goodness, we are not able to have absolute equality. We can have pretty good equality, pretty good fairness, the higher up you go in the mode of goodness. But it's not absolute. And it's still about me. And we may get angry when somebody messes up our mode of goodness. Just like these great yogis who get furious, you know, when somebody comes and, right? The rumba dancing girl, she came to Vishwamitra. He got so angry. Why are you here trying to disturb my mode of goodness? Because it's about my mode of goodness. You understand? It's about my mode of goodness. When we're like that, you know, why are you getting in the way of my service? It's very much like that. We get angry at other devotees. Why are you interfering with my service? It's a very similar kind of thing. It's about me and my happiness. So, but Krishna is the master of the modes of nature. So he's not affected by this. Interestingly enough, although Krishna says sarvadharmam prachaja mam ekam sharanam vraja, and we think Krishna thinks it's all about him. You know, Krishna doesn't think it's all about him. Isn't that fascinating? It is all about Krishna, but that's not his mentality. His mentality is, it's all about my devotees, it's all about all the living entities. Krishna is just giving himself unlimitedly to all the living entities. Just hearing this morning, Prabhupada was talking about the gopis' happiness is to make Krishna happy, and Krishna's happiness is to make them happy. Krishna's happiness is making the devotees happy, and the devotees' happiness is making Krishna happy. There's no enviousness. Prabhupada said in this world, he said, we don't admit it, but in this world we become happy at others' unhappiness and unhappy at others' happiness. He said, even in Krishna consciousness, if someone's advancing more than us, we become envious. This is when we think this unfairness. Oh, why does this person have a better chance at Krishna consciousness than me? This very doubt is based in envy. The doubt is not, it's not an intellectual doubt. It's not an intellectual doubt. It's a doubt because we're covered by envy. And therefore we become unhappy at others' good fortune. And we think it's a lack of fairness when I don't apparently have the good fortune of others. Whereas Krishna's mood and the mood of those who are above the modes of material nature, to try to get this point, they rejoice at others' good fortune. Therefore, others' good fortune becomes their good fortune. Isn't that amazing? When you're envious, you want to take others' good fortune so they don't have it anymore and you can have it. You want everyone else's good fortune to be your good fortune by taking it from them. But in transcendence, you know what? Everyone else's good fortune does become your good fortune because your happiness is on their happiness. The more you make others happy, the more you become happy. Isn't that amazing? And if you're in a world where everybody's having ever-increasing happiness and you're happy at their happiness, you're going to have ever-increasing happiness too. And therefore, the happiness of the gopis, when the other gopis enjoy with Krishna, is 10 million times greater than their own happiness. So that's our reality. And if that's true for the devotees, how much more so is that true for Krishna? Krishna is so non-envious. He has a Sharsati liberation where he awards the devotee his own opulences. Swarupya liberation. He awards the devotees his own form. Would we do that? Maybe after we die. After I die, then you can have all my opulences. And even then, people put in their will, well, I want to give less to this kid because they argued with me on, you know, July 2nd. This kid got disinherited them. Even in our death, we're envious. Hare Krishna. But Krishna's not like that. Krishna's actually giving equally to everyone. He will empower the living entity with his own potency. He allows the living entity, he encourages the living entity to taste his own ecstasies. When Krishna disappears in the Ras Lila, the gopis were tasting ecstasies from Krishna's perspective as if they were Krishna. How non-envious and equal is the Lord. So while we are covered by these modes of nature, we do not perceive things clearly. Therefore, if we want to be free of doubts, if we want to be free of doubts about Krishna's position, it is not a question of intellectualism and logic. That helps. Certainly, Krishna Das Kaviraj said we should apply our logic to the Lord. But if we really want to be free of doubts, we must come out of the modes of material nature. That's the only solution. And one becomes nista, or fixed in faith, when even 50% of passion and ignorance is gone. So just imagine how fixed we become when all the modes of material nature are gone. And the modes of material nature will be gone, as Prabhupada says in the first canto, simply by desiring to do so. Simply by desiring to see the truth. And the whole purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement is to increase and increase and increase that desire. So I'm sorry that there's so little time when you're talking about Jananda Mahatma. And see, today we have only about 3 or 4 minutes, but any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhupada.
You gave a very nice example of when you were 10 and you went to Hollywood and saw the set of the series that you were reading. Applying this to my material life.
Yes.
Have you
liked
the
phone? I'll repeat it.
I can understand that since I am caused by various mixtures of dunas, that I will keep making wrong choices.
Yes.
Hopefully less and less so with progress.
Yes.
What I don't understand is how in the original
state we made a wrong choice. The question, right? So his question was that when I was 10, I saw the Hollywood set and then I was no longer illusion. And he's saying, I can understand I'm making wrong choices because I'm covered. And I see as I get uncovered, I make better and better choices. How in a completely uncovered state could I make the wrong choice? And you know the answer, because we have free will. Being uncovered doesn't force you to make the right choice. Being uncovered simply shows you accurately the results of your choices. The ability to make the wrong choice remains. So why would you make the wrong choice if you see the results of your choices? There is not a rational, logical answer for that. It's like, why do people smoke cigarettes? You can't answer that question with logic. There is no logical explanation. There just isn't. You'll never find one. The answer is simply that we have the ability to choose to do something against our best interests. We have that ability. If we didn't have that ability, we wouldn't be living. And in fact, we wouldn't want to be without that ability. So let's say you made a list of all the things that you'd like to do but that you're struggling to do. All of us have a list like this of things I'd like to do but I'm struggling. So suppose you gave me that list and I came to your house armed with that list and armed with a gun. And I followed you around with the gun forcing you to do all the things that you say you want to do. Would you like that? So this is isn't that odd? That's odd, isn't it? Does that make any logical sense? This is what I want to do. I want to do these things and I'm struggling. But yet if you force me to do the very things I want to do, I'll throw you out of the house. If you came in the house with a gun and say, okay, Ramila, give me the list, or I'd throw you out. Free will allows us to become fools. It becomes clearer and clearer as we become less and less covered. Not only do our choices become clearer as we become less covered, but the reality of our foolishness also becomes clearer and clearer. We start to see how it is that that's possible. I don't believe that answer makes any sense to us at all until we start to become uncovered. As we start to become uncovered, hopefully I can just briefly tell you this before the curtain. So you know, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam, if you read through the 9th cantos, you become a self-realized soul at the end of the 9th cantos. So Burjan Prabhu is one of the few devotees in the world who's taught every single verse of the Bhagavatam, Burjan and Narayani, through all 12 cantos. So right after he finished, I had prasadam with him, and I said, so, did you become a self-realized soul? He said, oh yes. I've realized that I am a fool.